going to take us to Uganda. I'm Kirsten Stubenon. I'm presenting on behalf of myself and Jeffrey Edmeads. We're both with the International Center for Research on Women. And a co-conspirator of ours is in the room, Hannah Lantos, who wrestled with the data I will be presenting today for a long time. So thank you, Hannah. Just to broadly set the stage for this work, this is motivated by both the interest in the global health and development sectors to both reduce unwanted adolescent fertility, as well as to improve educational attainment outcomes for girls in towards a broader social economic development goals. And the notion of schoolgirl pregnancy has received a tremendous amount of policy attention, in part because in many countries there are policies that stipulate that pregnant girls must leave school. And one country where that's the case is Uganda. The ICRW worked with a Ugandan NGO that aims to increase girls' education, attainment, and retention, to examine the determinants of school dropout for girls of reproductive age in a specific region of Uganda where they were hoping to do programming, with a particular focus on the role of pregnancy in school dropout. And despite growing concern around schoolgirl pregnancy, the findings on the extent to which pregnancy causes dropout in many settings around sub-Saharan Africa are mixed. In part, that's due to legitimate geographic variation. Study done by Cynthia Lloyd and Barbara Mensch in West Africa shows that it's marriage rather than pregnancy, for the most part, that predicts or leads to dropout. Whereas studies recently in Malawi using longitudinal data show that pregnancy may be up to 30% of the reason for dropout in that setting. But there's also a tremendous difficulty in assessing the temporal order of events between dropout of school and pregnancy. And that's for a number of reasons, the first of which being that most of the data that we have to look at this are collected at one time point, cross-sectional data. And if you just look at the straight associations, it's very hard to establish causal inference. And a related problem is the data are often reported in whole years. So even if the data are set up to allow, using discrete time hazards models, are set up to allow for looking at which event comes first. If the data are presented in whole years, very often those events take place in the same year. And there's the notion of this density of transition in the adolescent period where dropout, first sex, pregnancy, marriage can all take place within one time. So again, it hinders causal inference. And then finally, studies have also shown the determinants of adolescent fertility and of school dropout share a number of determinants. For example, poverty and low household income are predictive of both adolescent fertility and dropout in settings. And one issue that we wish to draw out in particular is the role of gender social norms and expectations for girls versus boys, women versus men, as a significant predictor of dropout and also likely of pregnancy. So our specific objectives with the interest in producing rigorous assessment of the role of pregnancy and dropout, knowing we were limited to a cross-sectional data collection approach, was to try to identify and play with methodologies that might help us to get at a better way of teasing out the causal order and these relationships. And in addition, we wanted to examine more directly the role of gender norms and expectations in dropout. The setting is the West Nile subregion of Uganda, which is this orange space there bordering South Sudan to the north and Democratic Republic of Congo to the west. This is an area that itself has been subject to recent political violence. The Lord Resistance Army activity included part of the West Nile region, and also, of course, has an influx of refugees from both of these neighboring countries. It is a very underserved, almost uniformly poor region, where we also see real gender parity, unequal gender parity in education in this area in particular as compared to Uganda nationally. So national statistics, 8 out of every 10 secondary students are girls. In this region, it's 6 out of 10 secondary students are girls. And also, while the age of marriage in this region is on par with the national statistics, adolescent fertility appears to be increasing, and 19.7% of 15 to 19-year-olds, according to the DHS, most recently had a child already. So we did this work in 2 out of the 8 districts in the West Nile subregion, and it included 2 phases, a formative phase and qualitative work, and then a main data collection phase using both quantitative and qualitative approaches. For the quantitative work, we used a multi-stage stratified area cluster probability sample design. We looked just at girls ages 14 to 18 to capture that density of transitions, which the formative work had also pointed us to. Ages 14 to 16 were particularly dense. A lot happens in those ages. We included a total of 50 villages per were selected per district. 8 girls in each village were interviewed. And I'm going to just skip over this, but the survey included a lot of standard socioeconomic, sociodemographic, and education statistics, and also we looked at parents' support and tried to tease out different expectations for gender roles within the survey. But the effort at innovation, effort being the operative word, was to develop a life history calendar. And this is based off of the work of Shelley Clark and Nancy Luke, who did this for relationship histories in Kenya, where, and this was what it looked like. It was a fold-out calendar that started in 2007, went to 2013. We would pinpoint when the girl turned 12 and ask her about, the interviewers were to ask her about the transitions across a number of different events in her life. So the calendar was meant to be a visual aid to help improve the timing in which events are recorded. So she can see that an X has been put for where she reports a pregnancy, and then as she's going through with the interviewer where she moved from P3 to P4 in school and then dropped out, which one comes first? Oh, wait, hang on, I think I got that wrong. In theory, that's how this is supposed to work. It's a beautiful idea. The qualitative research, just to specify, we included a subset of 26 out of the 805 girls that were included in the quantitative work. We went back and did in-depth interviews with them to look more in an in-depth interview context at their life trajectory and dropout as well as transitions in their lives. So just overall, we found 31% of these girls, 14 to 18, were no longer in school. The average age among those who had dropped out was 15.3. Among the dropouts, 84% had dropped out in primary school, whereas at the age of 14, you're supposed to be already in your second year of secondary school. 10.1% of the girls had reported ever being pregnant, 22% reported ever having had sex, and 45% of the girls knew how to prevent a pregnancy, and only 39% knew where to source family planning. So there's a lot of significant issues in this community. I just want to underline that while the respondents stated that the main reason for dropout was pregnancy in 13% of the cases, this big green swath here, the majority cited financial reasons and poverty-related reasons for causing dropout. And this is going to get lost as we go through, so I just want to highlight it now. Just to give you a sense of where these data fall around different predictors that have often been cited in causes of dropout, As suggested above, this is an underserved region, and while at the bivariate level there are significant distinctions across our one variable here, looking at SES, which is the percent of homes that were a simple thatched roof design, you can see that there is a difference between dropout and in-school status. Oh, it's cut off. Sorry, the first column is in-school and the second is those who have dropped out. But nearly uniformly, these are very simple homes. We ran a wealth index that didn't do anything. It's just a real uniformly poor area. You can see, though, that education for the parents is low, and it's particularly low for the moms as compared to fathers, and that is also significant for dropout. This is an area where almost one-third of the respondents had experienced the death of a parent, and this was a predominant theme in dropout stories in the qualitative data. And the parental death is associated, of course, with the experience of conflict, which also impacted about one-third of the respondents in one way or another, but was not associated with dropout. However, I won't show this, but it was associated with pregnancy. Household-level gendered expectations was a theme that was prevalent in the qualitative data. Different expectations around domestic responsibilities in particular. And finally, a theme in the qualitative work that came up was just parents' inability to, just with their pressing demands to support children, to be there for children, children feeling like their parents didn't provide them the moral, emotional support that they were hoping to have. And for girls in particular, you can see the effects of feeling that their parents did not support her being in school when she was age 12 is significantly associated with her having dropped out. And of course, a number of school-related characteristics were important at the bivariate level, including self-rated performance and having to have paid for her own school fees and not starting school until after the age of 9. Also importantly, we included a series of variables that tried to assess girls' own gendered expectations and beliefs. And just to put this into historical context, only two or sometimes one generation ago, community members reported that women were not expected to go to school, that rather they were expected to bring wealth to the family through being married out and being received through bride wealth. And furthermore, that women were intentionally schooled less so that they would be subservient wives to the household head. While this is sort of recent history, in the qualitative interviews, parents did emphasize that they really wanted their girls to go to school as much as their boys. I mean, that was what they said. However, you see evidence of these gender perceptions still playing out in the girls themselves. So, for example, these are statements such as this: boys should be more educated than girls. You see that almost 50% of the girls who dropped out agreed with the statement, whereas this is much less the case for those girls who are still in school. And as I indicated before, there was girls having a high domestic burden and being held back from school too. So we used factor analysis to create a gender equitable scale that I'll show you in the multivariate analyses in a minute. So let's look at the relationship between dropout and different sexual and reproductive health events. You can see, if you're looking at it this way, you might be led to believe that ever having been in a romantic relationship, ever having sex, ever having been pregnant, or ever living or being married to a man is predictive of dropout. Certainly, it's much more likely the case that if you've dropped out, you will have experienced these events. And particularly with pregnancy and marriage, it's almost mutually exclusive to being in school, as policy currently would suggest, would dictate. But if you look at the timing of these events, and this is, so in order to get to these data, we struggled with the calendar data and where we had clean data. So we did a number of consistency checks to ensure, and so the sample size is reduced for each of these variables where we had consistent data across what girls reported in the calendar to what they reported in the more standard questionnaire. And in these cases where we feel confident about the ages, we were able to map it to either the month of the school term in which the event took place. So you can see that among the girls who report their first having had a relationship, the age of the first relationship is actually slightly, not significantly, but slightly higher for those who have dropped out versus those in school. Same for age of first sex, and then we weren't able to calculate the comparison for marriage or first union. So this is the first hint. And then this is our efforts to really show what's happening when. So this blue bar here is, for each of these cases, are the reports. This is among all girls who report dropping out, for whom we have clean data on each of these events. These are the cases for girls who report the event prior to their report of having dropped out. This is the cases where the timing happened within the same, within the month for sex, pregnancy, or first union, or within the length of a school term, so 3 months for first relationship. And then these are the cases where the event followed dropout. So you can see for relationships, the event tends to precede dropout before for in the majority of cases. But for both first sex and first pregnancy, while it's slightly favoring occurring before dropout, there is a significant percentage of cases that occur after dropout. And this is sort of a bit, particularly with pregnancy, against the conventional thinking that pregnancies are causing girls to drop out of school, whereas we see that in almost 50% of the cases, they're the consequence of having dropped out of school. And in this context, unlike in studies in West Africa, marriage is most certainly a consequence of dropping out rather than a cause. So our then revised estimate of the number percent of pregnancies that we would say have led to dropout would be 14.5% in these data. And then the qualitative data provide also a rich, which I won't have time to go into, but provide a rich understanding of these trajectories and how they take place. So in our interviews, girls described how the role of relationships in their lives in ways that might be counter intuitive, particularly to the extent that boys who were fellow students were really their main source of scholastic support. Girls talked about coming from households where your parents don't have very high education, in being a girl and in sometimes being held back to take care of domestic chores, a boy who is a good student, who is able to go to school more often than you, is a fantastic tutor opportunity. And then relationships would bud around those around those circumstances. And then girls also describe turning to relationships when parents have given up on providing them or can't provide them financial support or choose not to. And from the parents' perspective, there was a lot of discussion around the real fears of pregnancy among their daughters and what that would mean. And for these families, providing school fees and related materials is a significant amount of their income, and so the threat of a daughter becoming pregnant would be a real loss of any investment. And so parents talk about there were a few cases where a girl would describe her father having retracted school fees once they caught wind that she was in any kind of a romantic relationship because of that threat of pregnancy. So there's very complex trajectories happening. So we attempted to do some multivariate analysis with a small sample that we had of clean data. We didn't feel that we're not confident enough yet with the timing to do a discrete time hazards model. So what we did is we restricted the sample to girls who were between the ages of 15 to 18 and enrolled at age 15, and then we created variables that looked at those girls who reported a romantic relationship starting before the age of 15 or having had experienced their first sex before the age of 15 to look at whether or not those two factors then predicted dropout between the ages of 15 to 18. And even at the bivariate, they don't. So at the bivariate level, you see that first romantic relationship before 15 or first sex before 15 do not predict dropout for those girls who are enrolled at the age of 15. And just to quickly review those variables that do have an impact, we see that in what you don't see here, what's glaringly absent, are any socioeconomic variables. And that's because, again, we believe it's just because there just wasn't enough variation to see the impacts. But what's almost nice, not nice, but what that then allows us to really see controlling completely for the impacts of poverty are the impacts of gender norms and expectations. So we see that girls who reported their domestic chores interfering with school were more than three times more likely to have dropped out. We see that girls who have progressive gender expectations in that scale variable were far less likely to drop out. And girls who perceived that their parents did not support her being in school at age 12 were almost three times more likely to drop out. And mother's education rather than father's education was a more significant predictor of dropout in these models. So our lessons and limitations. The calendar method yielded really rich but really inconsistent, I mean not really, but at times inconsistent data. And it's a very intensive method to use. And I'd be happy to talk more about this during the discussion because I think it does have a lot of potential, but I think it needs to be done in a very hands-on, very intensive way, and I would recommend that it would be conducted by interviewers who are used to doing qualitative rather than quantitative interviews. There's certainly a number of biases in the data that we present. Those with clean data may be very different than those who don't have clean data. Likewise, we still aren't sure. We need to run some sensitivity analyses to see what the effects really were for our multivariate of the way that we set it up. And while we don't we also can't capture the real effects of poverty on the outcomes here, but the qualitative data certainly emphasize that. So, in conclusion, pregnancy does lead to dropout, but is also a consequence. And eliminating schoolgirl pregnancy would not eliminate teenage pregnancy in this setting. And we also see that the roles of gender norms are extremely prominent, both for girls' internalized expectations for herself as well as parents' influence on schooling. And then finally, in order to reduce the impact of sexual and reproductive health transitions on girls' lives and futures, we need to address sexual and reproductive health early through comprehensive sexuality education. We need to eliminate those policies that further exacerbate gender inequality in education through limiting girls to education if they've experienced a pregnancy, limiting their education, eliminating their possibility for education. And we need to critically address and question gender norms at the community and individual level. Directly. And I just want to thank the MacArthur Foundation for their generous support of this work and certainly the research participants and partners. And I have nothing to disclose.